Okay. Well, you know, over the last 15 years or so, Islamophobia has been developed as the most important excuse and justification for imperialist war. In the 19th century, imperialist plunder, colonialism and so on was justified as bringing, enlightenment, inverted commas, to the dark, savage areas of the world. Whereas today, the US murderous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the continuing genocide by the Israelis of the Palestinian people is justified by the supposed horrors of Islamic fundamentalism. And shamefully, many Western liberals and some on the left have fallen into line behind this chorus, being prepared to support Western intervention on the spurious grounds that it was bringing democracy or bringing women's liberation. Or alternatively, other people have stood on the sidelines or refused to give support for resistance movements like Hamas or Hezbollah on the basis of their Islamic roots. The war on terror, of course, has been used to justify and impose in country after country in the West horrendous anti-terror laws, and has led in turn to bans on the construction of mosques, bans on women wearing the veil, and so on. And in Australia, recently, the Liberal Senator, Corey Bernardi, called for a cutback on Muslim immigration to Australia and for the banning of the burqa. And, of course, in France, the law wearing the burqa in public has just started to be enforced just over the last week. And deplorably in France, many people on the left had supported the law banning the burqa, supposedly in defence of women's rights and secularism. And indeed, some on the left claim there is no such thing as Islamophobia at all. One example, one of the largest French Trotskyist groups, Ludivrière, argued, quote, that to claim the Muslim religion is under attack by the right is simply preposterous. While the Irish socialist group Social Democracy stated, quote, the reason why much of the racist discourse has taken on an anti-Muslim tone is because Muslims constitute the largest proportion of non-white immigrants. There is no basis for claiming that Muslims in Britain are facing discrimination because of their religious beliefs. Now, it is undoubtedly the case that anti-immigrant racism has been rife for at least 150 years. And there is no doubt an intersection between, broader anti-Arab racism and attacks on Muslims. However, the bans on the building of minarets in Switzerland, the opposition to the construction of mosques in country after country, the bans on wearing Muslim religious symbols in French schools and so on, are clearly attacks on Muslims as Muslims. It's not just an anti-immigrant thing, though the anti-immigrant thing is part of it. And moreover, it is not just Muslims from the Arab world or other parts of Asia under attack. At the recent federal election in Australia, there was a virulent anti-Muslim campaign against the Labor MP, Ed Husak, who's a Muslim from European background. So it's not just confined to Arabs or people from the Middle East in any sense at all. Before I go on to outline what I believe should be the left's response to Islamophobia, I think we have to say a few words about the more general approach that Marxists should adopt towards religion. And it is undoubtedly the case, I'd argue, that Karl Marx's statement that religion is the opium of the people is probably, the most famous quote by Marx himself. But Marx did not simply consider religion to be a narcotic that stupefies the masses. In the same section where the quote comes from, he went on to write, "Religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress, and also the protest against real distress. Religion is the sight of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world. To abolish religion as the illusory happiness of the people is to demand their real happiness. The demand to give up illusions about the existing state of affairs is the demand to give up a state of affairs which needs illusion. So that very clear Marxist position there, I would argue. Now, and religion then is not just something that helps people cope and survive in a heartless world. It can also be a symptom or a form of protest against that society, a form of protest against exploitation and oppression, which is reflected in the world, in the fact that over the centuries, many revolutionary movements have taken on a religious coloration. And it flows from this that Marxists are opposed to any attempt to outlaw or ban religion. The task of socialists is not to ram atheism down people's throats, but to build a mass political movement that can revolutionise the world. It is only genuine human emancipation based on socialist revolution that can lead to the withering away of religion. And precisely because revolution we made by the mass of workers themselves, it'll be inevitable that many of the workers that play an active role in that revolution will have religious ideas. Okay, well, at the centre point of a lot of the controversy about the whole question of Islamophobia and so on has been the veil. And, you know, the key debates there have been in France, where as early as 2004, the wearing of the headscarf was banned in French schools. And then last year in 2010, the law was passed banning the burqa in public. Now, many on the left, both in France and internationally, saw the burqa as a symbol of women's oppression and as undermining, the very wearing of it as undermining secularism. This is to ignore the long history of French colonialism and imperialism, in which Islamophobia was widely used to justify colonial rule in North Africa. And so, for example, during the Algerian War of Independence, French soldiers forcibly disveiled women and raped them. And what lies behind the ban on the burqa is a concerted attempt to whip up French nationalism, to divert attention away from the real issues, the attacks of living standards and so on that workers in France are facing, and to sidetrack that onto attacks on a religious minority. Islamophobia is tremendously useful to the right-wing Sarkozy government in France, which has engaged, you know, over the last 2 years in a concerted offensive against working-class living standards. The bottom line is that right across Europe, Muslims are under attack. And in that context, Muslims have in many ways become like the Jews of the 1930s. And imagine if in the 1930s, in the situation where anti-Semitism was rife and so on, the people on the left were saying, oh yes, but those Jews, you know, they're part of the problem because they wear their own religious dress. Socialists should defend the right of Muslim women to wear the headscarf in public. The idea that a law imposing itself on a small group of people from an oppressed minority is an advanced women's liberation is to simply turn reality on its head. Why would any progressive campaign for women's liberation target something worn by an oppressed minority community? You know, where has been, you know, a similar campaign against symbols of women's oppression worn in the mainstream community? Where is the campaign against women wearing makeup? Where is the campaign against women wearing high-heeled shoes? You know, which are just as much symbolic of women's oppression as the veil or the burqa. In many ways, more so in reality. There's no such campaign, of course. Now, in the left groups that defend the ban, and for example, Ludovriere argues to quote, to ban the veil at school is to allow young women who do not want to wear it to resist family pressures. But the problem reality there is, because even in that narrow terms, if that's what you saw you need to do, what's the reality? See, if you're under pressure, if you're forced to wear the veil because of your family pressure, and then the school says you can't wear it, what happens? Well, you're withdrawn from the school and put into an Islamic school. So how does this help resist any pressures anyhow? It's a nonsense. Socialists should oppose all forms of discrimination. There is no contradiction between fighting against the ban on headscarves in France and yet, on the other hand, in a country like Afghanistan, opposing the attempts by the state apparatus and the machine and so on, backed by the Americans, to force women to wear the veil. In both cases, it's about the state imposing itself on people. Now, as I said, the Lectin branch has not taken a good stand at all over this question. The committee of the French Parliament that drew up the law to ban the burqa was headed by a Communist Party MP. The Socialist Party and the Greens both have supported the ban. And at the time of the controversy going back some years, Ludovriere, for example, ran a banner headline on their paper declaring, quote, on the side of those who fight Islamic fundamentalism. Mm. And scandalously, some of Ludovriere's teachers' members were involved in a school by two sisters, the Levy sisters, who were converts to Muslim, who insisted on wearing a veil. And the teacher members of Ludovriere were central in the campaign to have them expelled from school. The other major Trotskyist group in France historically was the LCR, the Revolutionary Communist League. Its position wasn't as bad as Ludovriere's, but it's far from being a satisfactory position. They called for, at the time of the original bans in the school, that their position was, quote, neither the discriminatory law nor the oppressive veil. In other words, a cop-out position. And even worse, some members of the LCR also taught at the school where the Levy sisters were. And one of them said, and this is an appalling position, explained, this is supposedly a revolutionary, explained that while it would be preferable to find a way to avoid expelling them, they went on, we also don't want to exclude sanctions. The problem is that these students are pursuing a militant course of action. Of course, revolution is always going to get militancy. Now, to their credit, the LCR's youth group helped organise a rally in support of the two Levy sisters when they were expelled. But even there, one of the members of the youth group commented, quote, we think that it is necessary to fight alongside veiled girls. Fine. But, he went on, but in the course of the struggle, we hope to convince them that the headscarf is not a means of emancipation. So rather than a straightforward defence and solidarity with people from an oppressed group that are under attack and being victimised by the state, even their few left-wing defenders felt compelled to make it clear that they did not actually approve of them wearing the veil and that they were going to try to convince them they shouldn't be religious. And I think in many ways, of course, this is a capitulation to the broader Islamophobic sentiment that's widespread in France, but also reflects the confusion on the left more generally, but very acutely in France, that it puts it that, well, to be left-wing means you're axiomatically extremely hostile to any form of religious expression. In 2010, the issue erupted a new form when Ilham Mossad, a Muslim member of the NPA, the New Anti-Capitalist Party, was pre-selected as a parliamentary candidate by the comrades in her local area. And out of this, the NPA became under a withering attacks, you know, obviously by the right in society, but also by the Communist Party and other forces on the left, and by feminists. And one of the arguments used to condemn Elam was that the headscarf was supposedly an affront to women. But as Elam herself put it, and this is a quote from her, "These feminists say that it's a symbol of a submission. For my part, I'm not in the least submissive. I fight for women's rights. I fight for the right to abortion, the right to contraception. A certain number of women are obliged to wear it. I'll fight for these women too." Now, Olivia Bisconnel, the MPA's best-known national spokesperson, importantly, came out in a strident defence of Elam. That was a step forward. However, the MPA's official statement on it was merely mouth, to put it politely. They declared, "This is you defending your member under attack. The decision of the Vaucluse comrades cannot be taken to be the position of the MPA, since it has not been discussed in advance at any level of the party." Now, that's the sort of defence you want. It emphasised that, quote, "the headscarf is an instrument of subjection of women." In February this year, the NPA conference debated the whole issue of whether women wearing the veil could be candidates. And a motion to totally ban candidates who wore the veil was narrowly defeated by just two votes. Now, given the state of things in France on the left, actually that was a step forward, that it was defeated at all. And hopefully that will give confidence to those in the MPA and more broadly on the left that want to stand up to the, you know, strident Islamophobia to gain some confidence, to try to totally transform the attitudes of the left and start to campaign in support of Muslim rights. But what I want to go on to now is to deal with the whole question of what should be the Marxist approach to secularism. And that, because it's, you know, it's the idea of defence of secularism has been so upheld, and that. And indeed, much of the left has turned the idea of a militant form of secularism into being some principle of Marxism. I think this is a mistaken and utterly classless approach to politics. And it was not the approach of the mature Marx. As Alberto Toscano writes, and I think in a very important statement he wrote, "Marx's early writings can be understood in terms of the progressive realization that the attack on religion is always insufficient, or even a downright diversion, when it comes to attain its avowed ends. Repeatedly, atheistic criticism overestimates the centrality of Christianity to the state and treats the state's secularization as an end in and of itself." The guiding principle for Marxists has to be what advances the class struggle. What helps unite the working class in the struggle for human liberation and for socialism. And all the demands that socialists raise have to be judged in that light. Now, secularism, and defining it is very difficult, I think, but it's usually seen as being about the separation of church and state. But over the history of the last 200 years, it's taken on very many, very different meanings. In the aftermath of the American Revolution of 1776, separation of church and state meant that there was not to be a state religion, and that the religious freedom of minority religions would be protected. So the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution reads, "Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Now, socialists should clearly support such basic democratic rights. But this model of secularism is in many ways quite a limited one. So we have to be clear that the images of secularism, this was a counterposed religion. The reality was in America at the time, the Protestant churches supported this division, because they saw it as an advance. This would mean that they'd be free to operate, they wouldn't be restricted by the church, and would open up the possibilities of religious proselytizing. And the reality, of course, in America, that secularism didn't attack religion at all, for this version of it. Christianity maintains a privileged position in the American state. which is reflected in the American motto, which is adopted in the Cold War years, in God we trust. The saying of Christian prayers in Congress and state assemblies, paid chaplains in the army, you know, you can go on and on and on. You know, it's on the coin of the bloody country, for God's sake. The idea that there's any, you know, secularism has led to equality between believers and non-believers in America is absolute nonsense. Now, the French and Mexican Revolution saw a more militant version of secularism. The French bourgeoisie wanted to break the power of the Catholic Church, the largest landowner in feudal Europe, and a central pillar of feudal society. The bourgeoisie set out to break the church's economic strength by, you know, confiscating church land, and to break its ideological hold by breaking its control over education. But once the bourgeoisie had consolidated its rule, secularism in France, I'd argue, essentially lost all its progressive elements. In fact, demagogic priest baiting was used by middle-class politicians over the next 100 years to undermine the development of a class-conscious working-class movement. The Radical Party, the main bourgeois party in France before the Second World War, constantly appealed to anti-clerical sentiments to try to wall off workers from socialist ideas and to incorporate the working class in its institution into the liberal wing of the bourgeois state. Secular and Masonic groups were used in particular to incorporate the middle-class educated leaders of the socialist and early communist parties. And so serious the problem was that in the early 1920s, the Communist International was forced to pass a special resolution to do with France, outlawing communist membership of the Masons. On the other hand, as capitalism developed in Western Europe, the churches inevitably adapted themselves to it. And, you know, came to peace with the money-dominated secular society. Marx noted this very early on in his preface to Capital. He wrote about the Church of England. He wrote, "Nowadays, atheism is a minor sin as compared to the criticism of the existing property relations." And where previously bourgeois radicals, inspired by Enlightenment ideals, had sought to combat religion, in country after country, the bourgeoisie now saw secularized, pro-capitalist Christianity as a very important counterweight to the socialist movement. And let's be clear about, when we talk about secularism, what the militant secularism at the height of the Mexican and French revolutions meant. It meant bans on all religious possessions, bans on the right to vote for priests or any clericals, the outlawing of priests making any political statements, the ending of all religious suppression, processions, the outlawing of all religious orders, and so on. You go right through it. You know, outlawing church bells, the destruction of churches, and so on. That's what secularism at its height meant. Now, should really socialists today be supporting such severe anti-clerical measures? Now, clearly, if you look at the Australian case, we should oppose the fact that in Parliament they still say the Lord's Prayer. And even though in formal terms we don't have a state religion, the reality is that for most of the history of the Australian colonies, the Anglican Church existed as a semi-state religion, and of course they still say the Protestant version of the Lord's Prayer in Parliament. It's no surprise at that. Similarly, you know, there's a whole series of other elements in which the religion is incorporated in the state apparatus that socialists should be opposed to it. But should we oppose all intervention of the churches into politics as a breach of secularism? See, I think it's one thing to oppose the Catholic Church's attempt to impose its, you know, its religious ideology, in particular about sexual matters, you know, abortions, gay rights, and so on. It's one thing to oppose that. But should we oppose church leaders when they come out in support of anti-war rallies, or they decry poverty. You know, we should be denouncing it. The bishop the other day came out and said poverty is a terrible thing. We should, shall we just say, that's disgusting. Stay out of politics, you religious people. Well, it's a nonsense, of course. And the left doesn't, in practice, adopt that position. And that, if anything, they're too willing to get some bloody bishop to come and speak at an anti-war rally. And if you think about it, well, really, you know, I might resent the fact that they still say the bloody Lord's Prayer in Parliament, but really, this is the major thing holding back the class struggle in Australia today. I could name Julia Gillard and a few other atheists as being more of a problem, really. You know, so we have to see things in a sense of proportion. Because the reality is, in the advanced capitalist countries, you know, religion has been largely secularised. America might be partially exception, but even there, you know, and the bourgeoisie rules, the capitalist class rules, not the churches. Then we should turn to the education system, where clearly many of the battles against secularism have been fought. But really, is the key problem that a few young women are wearing veils to schools, or in the Australian case, that 20% of the population goes to Catholic schools? Are they the key problems holding back the class struggle? Or even the question of the schools? Surely the major problem is the schools, as overwhelmingly students are rummed into them are pro-capitalist measures, whatever school they go to. In France, secular education was seen as a key element of national cohesion, as a way of guaranteeing that class differences would not fracture national unity. And this is very clearly spelled out by Jules Ferrier, who's the founder of secular education in France. And this is the argument for secular education in France. He says, you know, at the time, in religious schools, the young receive an education which is entirely directed against modern institutions. You know, they support the old order, in other words. But that's not the main problem. We fear that other schools open to sons of workers and peasants will be founded with diametrically opposed principles. It may be these principles will be inspired by communist and socialist ideals. That was the justification for setting up the secular school system in France. In Australia, there is little evidence that the secularised Catholic school system turns out students that are more reactionary than the state system. Indeed, the Catholic Church has been singularly unsuccessful in selling its sexual morality to the product of its schools. And surveys show that in the question of abortion or contraception or homosexuality, Catholics have essentially the same attitudes as the rest of the population. And the teachers in Catholic schools are no longer nuns, just as likely to join a trade union and go on strike as anybody else. The other important context had to be added to this, that the demand for secularism, the bourgeois revolutions, was about breaking the power of the established churches. Catholicism in France or Spain or Italy, the Orthodox Church in Russia, Protestantism in Germany, but in a whole series of countries, whether it be Poland or Ireland or Australia or Germany, Catholicism was not the state religion. And neither, of course, was Judaism anywhere the state religion. The followers of these religions were discriminated against. Indeed, secularism was used commonly as an excuse to attack religious minorities. In Poland and in Ireland, Catholicism was the religion of an oppressed nation. And the struggle against national oppression then inevitably took on itself a religious coloration. In Ireland, the British imposed a secular education system. They imposed a secular education system in Ireland before they did in Britain itself. And this was means to undermine resistance to imperial rule. As one very influential study of Irish education put it, quote, the hedge schools, that's what existed before the education system, the modern education system, had been at academies of sedition. No such criticism was made of the national schools, where inculcation of loyalty to the established order was taught. Irish language, history and heritage did not find a place in the curriculum. And inevitably, in the light of this experience, when it came to Britain's colonies in the Antipodes, it was not likely to be the case that the oppressed Irish minority were going to embrace secular education. And their fears in the Australian colonies were heightened by the fact that the most important supporters of secularism, secular education in Australia, were the very same people who were calling for a ban on Irish immigration to Australia, and in the case of the report, Victoria demanding that Protestantism remain the state religion. There were anti-Irish riots in Melbourne in 1867, in Hobart in 1879, and in 1868 there was an incredible Fenian terrorism scare, very similar to the anti-Muslim terrorism scares after the attempted assassination by an Irish nationalist of Prince Albert in Sydney. And in a similar and a very striking fashion to Europe today, where the smaller liberals have been in the vanguard of fermenting Islamophobia, it was the radical wing of the colonial bourgeoisie in Australia, epitomised by the Melbourne Age, which played the decisive role in whipping up anti-Irish hysteria. And here's a quote from the Age at the time. It condemned, the quote, condemned the papish Irish who hated England's free, noble and just, glorious and dignified institutions. Now, the parallels with the fact that the Muslims supposedly hate us because of our values and democracy, well, I think it's pretty clear. In 1867, 55% of Catholic children in Victoria went to Catholic schools. By 1950, this had risen to nearly three quarters. So much for the idea that imposing secularism, secular education, or attempting to oppress the religious minority, you know, can drive them away from their religious attachments. It's a nonsense. So how should socialists respond to this phenomenon? The reality was, the key problem for socialism was not that religion was being taught in the Catholic schools, because after all, it was taught in the state schools, so that wasn't the difference. The key problem was that, of course, the competing state and Catholic school systems, once they became established, entrenched sectarian divisions in the working class. Now, and at the time of the debate about secular education in the Australian colonies, if there'd been a significantly sized socialist movement, you know, I think it would have had to argue for a genuinely integrated, non-sectarian school system. But, of course, no such party existed. And once the two school systems became entrenched, socialists had to adjust their tactics to deal with that reality. And in that context, you know, 30 or 40 years on, into the 20th century, for socialists to oppose the existence of the Catholic school system or oppose state aid to working-class Catholic schools could only further entrench the sectarian divisions. And the reality, of course, was the so-called mantra of secularism was used by the Masons and other bigoted Protestant groups in their anti-Catholic campaign. And indeed, for example, in the Victorian Labor Party in the 50s and 60s, right up to the 70s, which opposed state aid to working-class Catholic schools, the reality was that the so-called left-wing-controlled Labor Party branch in Melbourne was controlled by the Masons. And in this context, Marxists had to develop class politics and to point a way forward in class terms and combine that with flexible tactics. They could not make so-called secular education some overarching principle. The reality was, and there was a space, the Catholic Church hierarchy was campaigning for state aid to all schools, rich Protestant schools, rich Catholic schools, and working-class Catholic schools. Well, here was a line of demarcation which socialists could have inserted themselves into if they'd had the forces. By supporting state aid only to working-class Catholic schools, they could have split the Catholics along class lines. And there was real possibilities of doing that, because a number of surveys done at the Times indicated that most working-class Catholics were opposed to any subsidies to better-off Catholic schools. And in return for that, it would have been possible then to argue for the opening up of the Catholic school system to non-Catholic students and its effective incorporation into the state system. And that, the reason I go for some of that history, because I think it's very useful to understanding the situation of Muslims today. Because what do we say about Muslim schools today? You know, I have to say at one level, it's not a good thing. That increasing number of Muslims, not just in Australia, but in country after country, are starting to send their kids to Muslim schools rather than to the state school system. And you can understand why they do it. In the context of the degree of anti-Muslim discrimination that exists in our society, you can see that an Islamic school represents some sort of oasis for their children where they can escape from this oppression. But nevertheless, Muslims, you know, as a small minority, you know, this is a hopeless strategy. You know, it might be one thing for the Irish when they were 20-25% of the population to do it, and it was a dead end then. But for the Muslims to do it as 2-3% of the population, and that, you know, it's going to do nothing to overcome Islamophobia. The reality is that, you know, it has to be fought and overcome. But having said all that, it remains the case that it's an obligation on socialists to defend the right of Muslims to have their own schools, and given everybody else gets state aid, to defend the right for Muslim schools to have state aid. And to do otherwise would be to be implicit in Islamophobic attitudes. Now, the other controversial question has been the question of working with Muslim groups. Now, to dismiss out of hand any idea of working with religious groups, I'd argue, would be totally counterproductive for the left. So, for example, in Melbourne, the huge demonstrations, hundreds of thousands of people who demonstrated against the Iraq War, that was called by the Victorian Peace Network. Were socialists say they're not going to be involved in this because a lot of the other affiliates of the, you know, the Peace Network included, you know, the Buddhist Council of Australia, the Council of Churches, the Islamic Council, you know, the Catholic Commission for Social Justice and all this to say, oh, well, we're secularists. We're not going to be involved with all these people. What a nonsensical approach that would be. So absolutely, totally counterproductive. Now, okay. And let's be clear, such an approach, which some people on the left still defend, has got nothing in common with genuine Marxism. You know, long ago, Trotsky wrote, purely practical agreements such as bind us not in the least can be concluded with the devil himself. And that is advantageous at a given moment. So, you know, like the idea that there's some principle involved in this is nonsense. Now, other people on the left would argue, well, it's one thing to work with a religious group. It's a different thing to work with an Islamist group, you know, who are all clerical fascists or whatever term people want to apply. But again, to lump, you know, a broad spectrum of groups, from the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to Al-Qaeda to Hamas to, you know, Hezbollah, in all one bag of being Islamic fascists, I think doesn't add to our understanding. The logic of that approach, it was applied consistently. What would it have meant? That when the demonstrations occurred around Gaza in Australia, we should have gone along, and when the Hezbollah supporters turned up and the Hamas supporters turned up, well, they're a bunch of fascists, we should have attempted to drive them out of the demonstration. Now, as soon as you pose it in those terms, you have to think, this is lunacy. Now, the groups that have this position that they're Islamic fascists, do they do this? Well, maybe they do in some countries, but, you know, like to do this, you know, this would have, you know, these were some of the most militant people at the demonstration and we're going to attack them as they're just a bunch of fascists. It's a nonsense. The reality, of course, is that Islamic organisations and Islamist organisations are heterogeneous and that different tactics needed to be applied at different times, different circumstances, and so on. Clearly, it's very different if you're dealing with, you know, a reactionary regime in Iran or Saudi Arabia that cloaks itself in an Islamic guard. Clearly, they're the enemy, and you have to organise against them. There can be no coalitions with, you know, the Saudi regime and so on. That's totally different when the Islamists are not in control of the state, where they're an opposition movement, whether it be Hamas or Hezbollah and so on, though becoming fudge with Hezbollah now. And this is obviously the case when the Islamists are fighting foreign occupation. But similarly, I'd argue it's the case largely in the West, where in Western society the appeal of Islamism is largely to do with the oppression that Muslims and Arabs in particular are facing in these countries. As to how to tactically relate to these forces, I think that was well spelled out in the Marxist movement early in the 20th century by Alexander Pavus, who was a collaborator with Trotsky, when he wrote, in the case of a common struggle with casual allies, what should be our line of march? One, do not merge organizations. March separately, but strike together. Two, do not abandon our own political demands. Three, do not conceal the divergence of interests. Four, and I think this is a good one, pay attention to our ally as we would pay attention to an enemy. Five, concern ourselves more with using the situation created by the struggle than with keeping an ally. And I think those, criterion very much still apply for Marxists today. And clearly, there are dangers in collaboration and working with Islamist groups, just as they are such dangers working with all sorts of other smaller liberal or reformist forces. It can lead socialists to minimise the importance of elements of our political identity which might embarrass our allies. Nevertheless, while the dangers of accommodation to Islam, Islamists, are real enough, the greatest danger of the left in the West, and my talk tonight is overwhelmingly about the left and the left. I'm not talking about strategy and tactics in the Arab world and so on. The reality, the danger, the error that most of the West and left have fallen into is the opposite one. A scornful dismissal of people from a religious background, a sectarian refusal to work in common struggles with Muslims, or a failure to wholeheartedly defend the rights of Muslims when they're under attack because, of an uncritical adherence to bourgeois secularism. And this has been compounded by a tendency on the left to overstate how reactionary Islam is on questions to do with women and gays and so on compared to other religions. And reality is, the common sense, of what Islam says today is essentially what, all the Christian religions and so on in the West were saying, 20 or 30 years ago. There's no difference. It's just, a slight time gap. And these errors all represent accommodation to the Islamophobia that is so prevalent in Western capitalism. And in this context, the key issue for socialists should be how do we defend the rights of religious minorities that are being scapegoated, not joining in with the scapegoating in the name of secularism. The genuine Marxist tradition, unlike bourgeois atheism, does not see religion as the root of all evil, but the social system in which religion flourishes. To overcome that social system, we have to unite the working class across all its divides, whether racial or religious. I'll leave it there.